Hello, everyone. It's John Salvis and Ron Yengich back once again for another episode of the Bingham Boys podcast. We're, again, like I said, on number three. The first two we've had a lot of fun at, had a lot of great feedback. And we just are two guys that want to reiterate over and over again that our roots are strong, Utah roots, and they're not the same as everybody else's, but they're just as valuable and just as important, and we're going to keep beating that drum because it's a drum beat that went too shy for too long, and we're reclaiming it. And not just that, but we also remain very, very committed to our Bingham roots and tell those stories, and we're also intertwined with politics because that's just the kind of people we are and the way we were raised in our lives and our work history. So, Ron, how was your past week?
My week went well, John, and I was looking forward to coming back here today, but I don't see you. I hear you on the interwebs. What happened?
Yeah, well, I'm a little bit dazed and confused today. That's obvious. I believe it's obvious. Over the weekend, I went on a little bike ride. I like to ride my bike as much as I can, not strenuously, but take bike rides. And, you know, towards the end of it, I slowed down at an intersection. I'm talking about a bicycle, not a power bike. And myself and a car met, didn't collide. I was waving him on. He was waving me on. And in that few seconds of like slowing down and almost not moving, my balance said, you know, I'll see you later. At which point I took a face plant into the sidewalk. So I ended up in emergency for a few hours and left a whole trail of blood for about a mile and stitched up, bruised up, pretty swollen up. I look like Ron, you're a boxing fan. What's the worst looking boxer that ever exited the ring? That's who I look like right now.
Well, I'd say you look a little bit like George Chavallo.
God.
Croatian boxer who defended with his face a lot, but he was a great fighter.
He led with his face.
Yeah, great guy. And so, yeah, I would say that. Well, we have a call in here, though, John.
Yeah, okay. Well, one sec. Chavallo, though, just going back, I mean, who remembers Chavallo? Did he go the distance with Cassius Clay Ellie?
Yes, he did. He fought a lot. I mean, he fought till late in his boxing life. And after he left the ring, he had had a lot of problems with substances. And he spent his life, I think he died recently. He might be still alive, but he spent his life helping other people that had suffered from that type of illness or problem, addiction problems, and also help people with mental health issues that he also suffered from. But he was a great boxer and a great guy and a tough guy. I mean, he was tough.
He was tough. Well, thanks for the compliment, backhanded. Yeah.
Well, it is. I mean, it is a backhanded compliment. Actually, it looks like a jab and a hook compliment. But
anyway. Yeah, they got me at the same time. Yeah.
So we have a call. Bill, line one.
Oh, we're taking a call. This is new.
Yeah, John, this is Tommaso. I'm calling you. I know that you use that excuse about the car, but if you need us to talk to some guy, we'll go out and talk to him, and you know what I mean. And then after we're done talking to him, they're going to feel like they worked on the main line with Red Green as their boss and Kamiya as their section foreman. You know what I mean? That's how they're going to feel. They're not going to feel good. They're going to be rookies. So you just give me a call if you need some help, okay? Is that a deal?
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah. You know, Ron's kind of talking about, you know, I screwed up and I do need a little help here. But what he's indicating too is like in the mine where we work, you know, guys get hurt. And I spent time at the clinic there in Bingham. Might as well, you know, why don't we have Bingham Clinic be our sponsor here today, if that's the case, Ron?
I think that's a great idea.
All right. So I remember you were well prepared last week doing the sunset. I'm not as well prepared, but I can tell you that today's podcast of the Bingham Boys is brought to you by the Bingham Clinic on the west side of Main Street, Upper Main Street, a little two-story building just above Markham Gulch. And it's the home of where all of us, when we were young, it was It replaced the Bingham Hospital and then became a clinic. And we all took our physicals there, and it was manned by doctors that would come up from the valley by the time we were young. Two notable of those were Dr. Hargraves and Dr. Gubler, and everybody had their favorite, and everybody had which one they feared. Usually Gubler, I believe, was the feared one, but I liked Gubler. And upstairs was a dentist that was, any kid in Bingham had the terror story of what that machinery looked like. When you went in there, it was really like a science fiction movie of dentistry. It was very, very old and ancient stuff in there. Everybody had, they would rather have cavities, frankly, rather than fix their teeth. But at the clinic, you know, we had the two doctors, and what I liked, and I guess in a weird way liked, but it was what it was. You know, the doctors there and the nurses that were there were male nurses. I'd never, so from early on, I knew what a male nurse was, and I was never apprised to think anybody would be ashamed to be a nurse because of those guys. I think they were basically Army or medical corpsmen left over from World War II or Korea or something, because one was called Army Johnson. And then everybody loved Harry Neff. He was there for a long, long time. And I had my tonsils out there when I was young at the clinic. And everybody will recognize when they walked into the clinic what it smelled like. It smelled heavily of ether.
Exactly.
And you would just immediately know you were in a different place. Well, I had my tonsils out using ether to put me to sleep. And that's a terrifying experience. I'll tell you, to be 4 or 5 years old or younger and your dad holding you down by your throat while the doctor throws a towel of ether over your face. It's why I could never become an auto mechanic. That ether smell to this day, that it's like starting, what do you call it? The starting spray when you, in a cold morning, you spray in your carburetor or something. Yeah. And I could never do it. It was awful. But when it was done, the doctor graciously brought out my tonsils and showed them to me in a bottle. They were really cool. Never wanted to be a doctor as a result. Never wanted to do anything bloody until I smashed my face on the curb the other day. Went from there, walked up the street a little ways or across. I don't know exactly because I was young, but went to Union Drug and bought a popsicle. And that was that. In and out.
The area where the clinic was when we worked up at Kennecott in the summers was really part of the old hospital, actually, I think. But anyway, I remember going in there when we lived in Highland Boy because the doctor was there. And he was a doctor that moved to Murray and remained our family doctor for a while. But anyway, I got hurt. I don't know. I cut my hand or something. And so they sent me down from wherever we were working on the track gang, and I went in there, and Dr. Gubler, and he didn't have exactly what is a great bedside manner. They didn't teach that when he went to Ms. Goldstein.
Did he ask you for a cigarette or a match?
No, but I'll tell you what, he didn't ask me whether or not, he didn't tell me whether it was going to hurt or not. He just stitched it up without any type of pain medication. Because it wasn't a big deal, but it was funny. I had admiration for those guys, he and Dr. Hargraves, and then before them, a fairly...
Dr. Jenkins was up there for a long
time. Yeah, that's who I was thinking of that went to Murray, and he went to Midvale and then to Murray. But all the Bingham families that moved down into the valley remained with those people, and Hargraves remained my doctor until well into I was practicing law before he retired. But the thing about those men and the people that worked there was very simple. They were straightforward. They weren't looking into their computer typing in things. They were looking at you. They were looking at what the problem was, and they listened to you. And they also told you the truth. They told you whether or not it was a real problem or it wasn't. And if they told you it was something that was going to heal, if you did what they told them, it healed. And I really admired their attitude. The most famous of them was a guy named Dr. Frazier. And he went to the North Pole, I think, with Perry's expedition.
He went with Admiral Byrd.
Admiral Byrd. Thank you, John. But a very famous man. He had somewhat of a checkered history because of some of the things that he had been involved in as a young man. But be that as it may, once again, a great man and a man that everybody in Bingham Canyon knew and in many respects revered.
Yeah, I'd like to have another episode, not today. We'll talk about Dr. Frazier. He was obviously incredibly well-known and revered up there. I know what his checkered past is, what you're referring to, and that's why I think it requires more time. My dad went on expedition for him down into Marble Canyon below the Grand Canyon. I'm sorry, below Glen Canyon, between Glen Canyon and Grand Canyon is Marble Canyon, and doing some investigations and discovery for him on his behalf. And they found a bunch of figurines that are thousands of years old that they're now exhibited at the Smithsonian in D.C. and also at the University of Utah. There's a long story there. But get this, Ron, his exploring partner was Joe Berger.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Tell them who Joe is.
Well, that's another story too. Okay. But Joe Berger was another incredible, like Chicago Charlie last week. We'll get better at this and describe in a little bit more detail. Didn't you say, Ron, somebody mentioned we didn't learn a lot about Chicago Charlie?
Well,
we continue to bring him up, though. There's all kinds of stuff. And Joe Berger's the same. He requires a whole episode.
One of the commenters indicated that he would like us to go back and talk some more about Chicago Charlie, and I believe he deserves that. So we'll do it in another episode. But there were a lot of people like that that came from Bingham and that had lives that transcended them living in the canyon.
Right. Well, look, let's I'll just mention this time what we're doing. You know, we reminisce about our past and we try to tie things together. One body of people we're going to recognize pretty quickly here are some well-known women from Bingham, and talk about them in a future one. But, you know, I mentioned, Ron, when the injury, you know, I went to the clinic numerous times getting hurt. I got stitches all over me from when I was a kid from those doctors. And what I had when my tonsils were taken out was going to Union Drug and getting the popsicle. And that'll bring us into another chapter of Bingham, the Jimmis family and the things that they brought to the canyon, the Union Drug and the House of Copper and so on. But emphatically, Ron, moving past that, did we tie down everything on the new Pope, Pope Leo? We've done it two times now. Is there anything left to do, number three? You're a student.
Well, we haven't talked about Pope Leo himself, but I think it's relevant. We talked about the conclave on Tuesday of last week, and then on Wednesday, he was elected Pope by the Cardinals. But when I was watching, and when he came out and he indicated that he was going to take the name Leo, it just hit me and brought a smile to my face, because there are two real famous Pope Leos, and there are a number of them are well known in church history. One is Leo the First, Leo the Great, who stared down the tyrant Attila the Hun, who wanted to come down and sack Rome, and went out and met him and talked him out of sacking Rome. He is the I guess patron saint of those who oppose tyrants. Without going into anything today, I mean, there's symbolism in that. More importantly is the idea, and he's indicated this, Pope Leo XIV is indicated afterwards, that he took that name because of Pope Leo XIII. And just a little bit of background on what that means, particularly to working people. Pope Leo XIII was the first pope who really outlined what Catholic social teaching is on the rights of working people and the rights of the poor. He wrote an encyclical back in about 1893-ish. It's called De Rerum Novarum, and it's a Latin term that really doesn't mean a whole lot. It basically is the first two words of any papal encyclical. But the gravamen of that was that at the time when the Communist Manifesto had been written, people were looking at socialism and communism was at the same time that we had the explosion in the Industrial Revolution. And so workers were trying to assert their rights and had been doing so for a while. Even in America after the Civil War, there were guilds and unions and there had been problems. But what Pope Innocent XIII, and again, the new Pope has indicated, Leo XIII, I took his name because he's the Pope that stood up for the poor, for working people, in the face of those two real enemies, communism, which says no God exists, and the state is the religion of the people, and the industrial magnates who were accumulating vast and incredible wealth and didn't seem to care about working people or the poor. They were simply widgets to be used in manufacturing. They were throwaways, as the old saying used to be, if there's a cave-in in a mine, save the mules. If a bunch of Bohunks die or a Dagos die, it doesn't matter, whoever, because we can get them. They're a dime a dozen. But you have to train a mule to go underground.
That was Rockefeller, and it was a mining disaster in Colorado. It's a documented story. So yeah. what you're saying here, in the prior industrial revolution, but begat the late 1880s or early 1890s and lasted for quite a few decades. American Revolution? I meant the American, the industrial revolution. So during that time, that's when Pope Leo XIII wrote his encyclical, correct?
Right.
And now, a little over 100 years later, we're seeing a repeat of that?
I think we're seeing a guy that looks at that and has read it. It's interesting reading. It's not that long. I've got a copy of it right in front of me. And the discussion is very simply this. Human beings individually are important. They're unique. They need to be treated fairly. They need to be treated with respect. They want work. Work is a good thing. It's important that every individual has a job where they can earn a living for their family. They can worship based on the dictates of their conscience. But they have to also not only make money, they also have to have time off. They have to be able to enjoy what they earn and work hard. And they have responsibility when they work. And that is to say, they've got to work and be fair to the employer. But they can't just be treated as throwaway things. Well, it was revolutionary, because this is the head of the Roman Catholic Church saying, really for the first time in this manner, this is what we teach. This is what we believe in, consistent with the gospel. And so, with Leo XIV taking that stand, where we are today with the vast accumulation of wealth and the treatment of immigrant people, which most of the people from Bingham that worked in the mine were, and other places, the need to treat them with respect. And so I think it was a signal about who he's going to be and what his pontificate is going to be about.
I'm sorry, you want to continue?
No, go ahead.
I look forward to it then, because, I think you and I, in ways that were kind of lost in these recent years, and many, many other people, not having that voice for the working people or rooted religion people, because you and I didn't grow up Protestant America. We grew up in, you as a Catholic, myself in the Greek Orthodox religion, and that's where we grew up, with those values attached to everything that we were. And so many of our peers and so on kind of left religion. And I'm not talking about faith per se, but religion often does leave with somebody who's listening all kinds of basis points to live a good, honest, and a life of integrity, of hard work, of compassion, empathy, all those things that were just common back in our early era that are not so common today. And I'm glad that you're bringing that up, and this is an opportunity to talk about those rooted values that came over with our grandparents of the ethic they brought and is not taught here. In fact, when you and I were young, we're somewhat frowned upon, not the ideals per se, but the fact that we practice our religion differently and kind of hit the shadows with that way too often. I believe I would like to see a recurrence of voices for hard work and ethics and moral standing and putting good people out with their first steps forward in front of us to lead us, not just randos that can talk loud.
Now, I think I would just want to quote briefly from this. It's pretty cool. He says in the midst of it, when there is a question of defending the rights of individuals, the poor and badly off have a claim to especial consideration. The richer class have many ways of shielding themselves and stand less in need of help from the state, whereas the mass of poor have no resources of their own to fall back upon and must chiefly depend upon the assistance of the state. And it is for this reason that wage earners, since they mostly belong to the mass of the needy, should be specially cared for and protected by the government. He goes on to say that the rights of people to organize unions, and we just had that issue here in the state of Utah with public workers, is tantamount to them being able to have a voice. And so again, not to harp on it too much, this is really kind of a seminal time Forrest, going back and revisiting those type of things. And if I can tell one story, I told you I was going to tell you this, John. Years ago, as time progressed, my dad and others began the renewal of the attempt to organize Kennecott and the unions at Kennecott. And there was a lot of pushback from the company. And communism was always used as a bête noire. If you were a union guy, you were a communist. And of course, Red Scare tactics have been employed in America ever since the teens, right after World War I. But anyway, the company went to my dad and Joe Dispenza, a man that we both have amazing respect for, God rest his soul, who was the president of the mine mill and smelter workers in Bingham. He went to their priest because in 1955, Pope Pius XII had said, if you're a member of the Communist Party, you are automatically excommunicated from the Catholic Church. You lose all rights as a Catholic for the sacraments. And that was because of the issues that were going on between America and the Western world and the communist powers at that time, Stalin and then Khrushchev. They went and told the bosses at the mine went and told Father Sullivan that they were communists and that these guys were going to strike and they were being led by two communists. And I'm sure Father, soon to be Monsignor Sullivan, took him in and read him the Riot Act. And they defended themselves, probably together and then individually, and convinced him, because they were not communists. They were just working men who believed that a union was appropriate for the workers in that mine. And the Catholic Church in Bingham had not been overly open about their sympathy for the working people who they saw in the pews of all the churches up there every Sunday. But Father Sullivan, after that, came back and he went to the bosses and said, hey, look, you lied to me. These guys aren't communists. And by the way, I won't let anybody starve in this canyon if there's a strike this year. I will make sure that we feed them, which was always a fear. It's an interesting story, and it was written up a number of years ago by a great writer for the Tribune, Tom Wharton, who just died. And I thought that all stems back once again to Leo XIII's encyclical on the rights of working people. And I think you knew Tom.
I did know Tom. Well, his father was my grade school principal when I was in Copperton Elementary. I was probably in about fifth grade. Tom was older by 2 or 3 years, I don't remember, and he would visit with his father. Everybody loved Tom Wharton Sr. He was a great, great guy for our community and everything. But what it did was it kind of ingrained in younger Tom his love for that community. Bingham High School was a recipient of nice things that Tom would cover later on in sports. He'd often refer to his time in Bingham Canyon. He and I much later on became, we almost towards the end of his career, probably at the Tribune, before we really reconnected other than casual notes, having a lunch and so on and talking about it. He was very well versed and fond of that community for all the right reason. He, by the way, as you well know, is a Catholic man. And I don't know what became him later on, but he was certainly involved in the Catholic Church at one point of his life. And that's, you know, continuing that little bit of a theme that, you know, here you and I are people that if you looked at us on the street, you would think that, you know, maybe you are a communist because you look that way, you know, but really, you know, anymore, I don't think people know what a communist is. It's just a buzzword, socialist, communism, woke, all this kind of stuff is all distraction words. It really just boils down to a certain kind of person that isn't any longer unaware of where they grew up and what they want to be, and they're quite proud of their heritages. All about ethnicity and religion too; they're intertwined.
Well, it's where you come from, and it doesn't make anybody good or bad, but there's an ethic to life that I failed at repeatedly in my 2 days, 75 years old, and 3/4 of a century. God. How often I've failed to learn the lessons of my own history. But it's the effort that is made, and it's not forgetting your history. I think one of the reasons we're doing this podcast is not to proselytize anybody, but say, here are two guys that come from a certain community that no longer exists, that was conjoined from different parts of the world and the United States, who kind of lived a very similar outlook on life. And their outlook on life had to do a lot with hard work, being honest, being truthful, and the highest thing that you could be referred to is he's a good guy.
Those are the currencies I grew up with, and we talked one in the first, and we need a new scorecard. The scorecards I had when I was young were never money. They just weren't. If you had some great, that just meant you could have a little bit, an extra beer or something, or a kitchen, buy more worms to go fishing or whatever. It's really not because it's just a simpler time. It's just the values were different, and they were just what you just mentioned, rattled off. If compassion was a nickel, then honesty was a dollar, and somewhere in between was a 50-cent piece. Piece called empathy and goodwill and good nature and all that kind of stuff. That is what's lost, and that's what I yearn for. That's the greatness that I remember. It wasn't about bustling, you know, stock markets, that kind of stuff. I get it that that's important, absolutely, but that's only important to a fractional. And societies are maintained, sustained, grow, and leave legacies not on economies, but what kind of people they left behind. What kind of cultures they preserved, what kind of people they were. And that's what I yearn for. That's what I speak for now. And if it roots back to Bingham or who you and I are, then all the better for now. And you're right. This isn't about proselytizing. It's about maybe, you know, you mentioned your age, and I don't mean to be morbid, but, you know, a little bit of deathbed legacy here that we get to write our own obit a little bit and say, yep, We screwed up here and there, but here's what we got right, and here's what we hope to impart that's right going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see my expiration date. It's somewhere on my back, and I can't see it.
Yeah, I'm not looking for it. I'm not going to ask you to turn around either.
No, and I wouldn't want to do that. But the reality is, I think that one of the great things about growing old is the idea that you can reflect back on people that you admire when you were young or when you got older. And speaking of which, you know, we talked a little bit about this. Maybe this is a good time to go about, you know, big thing these days is NIL money at the universities. And there were a lot of great athletes that came out of Bingham Canyon and Bingham High School. And I'm a beat digger, but in my heart, I've always been a Bingham guy and will, except when I was playing Bingham in sports. But, you know, I was thinking about NIL and the amounts of money that are out there. I see Cameron Rising just retired, and he should. He was injured, but he got almost $1 million on the table, not under the table, to play quarterback at the University of Utah. And I wonder what some of the great athletes from Bingham would have to say about that. I mean, I think of Jim Jimmis particularly, but there are a lot of others. He was such a great basketball player at Bingham, and then sadly went to BYU. We Utah fans say sadly, but then was a fantastic coach, or a guy like Georgie Sluga, who is a great basketball player, great high school coach, great baseball player, by the way, too. I wonder what they would have been able to get today under these circumstances.
I would have liked to have seen any of them make a dollar. You know, I can rattle off a few. I'll start with one. It's my brother. He was not known, but in terms of later on, but at in Bingham High School, he was quite legendary. Lettered about 10 times. And got a football scholarship to the University of Utah in 1958. He quit after his freshman year or something, just quit school, but he was quite the ball player. But he had mentors in front of him. And just 2 or 3 years in front of him was one guy we both know and like a lot. We call him Tom Lavotte. It's Dave Lavotte. Tom was a great football player, and he went to the University of Utah, coached the University of Utah, but later on coached for the Green Bay Packers and has a Super Bowl ring on his hand. So there's Lavotte, and before Lavotte, and about the same era, was Jack Mannion.
Right.
And his son, Pace Mannion, played for the University of Utah.
His other son played football for the Y, and then his third son was a baseball player, I think, for Cal State Fullerton. Great baseball player, too.
Right. And then going back a little bit farther, there were some great ball players in the in the 40s. But, you know, the war interceded and took a lot of careers away from guys. But just before the war, right after the war, I think, was Jimmy Brown. He later Stevens and Brown Sporting Goods. He was a great baseball player, Greek, out of Bingham Canyon. From your side of the canyon, Tommy Pizzell was a promising. He was in the Boston Red Sox baseball organization. Had the misfortune to go to Anzio or Sicily in Italy during World War II. I don't exactly know where, but he was fighting the fascists in Italy when a German round shot up his knee pretty badly and ended his baseball career. You mentioned Tommy George Saluga, great guy, my old neighbor. I love George.
Georgie, he's one of the, George is, as the Latinists say, sui generis. He is totally unique. There is only one George Saluga.
Nobody, and his father was something else out of like Carbon County. That's where they were from. He lost an uncle. George lost a great uncle or an uncle in a terrible mining disaster in Castle Gate. In just above Price. And there was like 150, 200 miners died like instantaneously. And he was one of them.
If you go to Castle Gate, you can find George Sluga's relative on a plaque.
Yeah, it's on the plaque. But on that same plaque are the names of 50 Greeks. 49 of those Greeks were from the island of Crete. They were all my grandfather's buddies. My grandfather worked in that mine, left the mine because he thought it was dangerous. So, you know, it blows up. And anyway, that Sluga came out of from down there. There used to be baseball leagues, and Frank Zaccaria was a Carbon County guy, but played ball up here. There were softball leagues, like Bingham would play Magna and different companies. He was one of those guys. But here's one that people often overlook in bowling. Did you ever know of the name Ann Slattery?
Sure. That was her married name. I'm trying to think of what her so-called maiden name was, because she was Croatian. The old man used to talk about her a lot. There was a famous woman golfer, bowler, track star.
Zacharias. Zacharias.
Yeah, exactly.
Diedrichsen or something
like that. Zacharias. And my father would always take the position that Ann Slattery was a hell of a lot better athlete than she was. Of the national.
Well, she's Croatian.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it got. One other guy, and I know you didn't do it intentionally, Tom Lavott, Dave Lavott's brother, Jim, was a great football player at Bingham and a great basketball player and a great baseball player. He ended up playing up at Idaho State, and he coached me one summer in the summer leagues that we used to have where Salt Lake County Recreation had baseball teams and all kinds of stuff every summer at the schools, so kids had a place to go. We don't do that anymore, which is stupid. And then we would play other places. We played at West Jordan and Midvale and Murray and all over. You got to play other school teams when you were a kid, which was fun. And I learned a lot from Jimmy.
He was my brother's age. I remember him visiting our house when I was young, and then I think they lived in Lower Bingham in Frogtown about that time, the Lavott home. I remember going past there.
You mentioned the Mannions, and interesting thing, Tom Mannion, Jack's father, was a union guy, union leader. He came from, he's Irish, came from England, though. I don't know how he got to England. My dad told me more than once, because they were close, Tom was older than my dad, about what a great soccer player Tom had been in England or Ireland, I forget which, and was kind of like the equivalent of being an All-American in that sport back in his home country.
He was a fine man, and he was our traffic, you know, the grade school, when you walk across the street, he was our traffic coordinator across the only street in town. I was going to mention, Mannion Pace, he would have gone to, well, it didn't work out this way. Who was the Roberts kid that was really good? He didn't grow up in Bingham. He played the pro ball.
Fred Roberts
and Pace Mannion. Had fate not intervened, would have been on the same high school basketball team at Bingham.
Yeah, that's true. You know, Pace's son, Nico, played for University of Arizona, was a great player. And I think he's playing in the European leagues now. And Pace had a great career. He had a really good career in the NBA, but he played and was a star in the Italian league. Just some great people. And for those of you who want us to be quiet about it, it's because you don't know those names, there's a point here. And the point is that sports were big in Bingham, and the rivalries were big. I cannot tell you how much, if I could go to any sporting event, and I'm going to Milwaukee to watch baseball this coming week for my birthday, I would want to go to a Jordan Bingham basketball game, high school basketball game, either at Bingham's gym or Jordan's gym, because I've never been to any sporting event, and I've been to SEC games. I've seen a lot of sporting events. I've been to World Series. I've never seen the intensity of Jordan playing Bingham in high school basketball when I was a kid.
It was a great gym at Bingham. We lost it, of course, when they tore it down after the school was abandoned. Had one of the classic football fields in the entire state, in a little natural little valley up there that was surrounded by three hills, and they had the lights on. We had lights before anybody else had lights. Bingham under the lights. Hey, but listen, there's only one more guy that you forgot, and then we should move off of this and, you know, just move past and get our next part. But there is a statue, you've probably seen it, on the way to Bingham Canyon, and it's kind of off in the dry farms a little bit, but it's a statue of a guy taking a fadeaway jump shot. It's Danny Brentel. Legend has it he made a long jumper one time. He Danny was mentioned in our first broadcast. He went to Vietnam as a Green Beret. He did play basketball for Westminster, but Dan's a great guy. I'm just teasing.
No, I'll tell you the truth. I thought of Brentel. I figured we had to end on him. We both worked on the copper with him, on the college gangs, and there's no better guy in the world. He and his buddy Joe Miller, they're like twins, the Cats and Jammer kids together, but there's no better guy than Danny. And between he and Brent Marriott, who played at Jordan at the same time, maybe a little after Danny played, two of the best shooting guards I've ever seen at that time. I mean, they both could shoot. Brent went to Utah State and had a great career, but great guys, and they were hilarious to work with.
Well, hey, look, we've gone this far. We haven't brought up what's been our theme topic, default theme topic for a while, and I think we should probably stay off of it this time. And that would be, and maybe there's a little bit there to talk about our president, but I don't want to dwell on him. Every day is a new day of what the hell's going on in my world, and it occupies a lot of time if you pay too much attention. So without talking about Trump very much, what have you got to say about our president this week?
Well, I mean, it's easy, and I know that we receive some people who think that we focus on that too much, and I think that's fair. I mean, but what we're talking about, as we talk about our roots and what we believe in and what we try to emulate, is honesty and the idea that honesty can get you wherever you want to go. You don't have to cheat, steal, or lie about it. And it's just that our president comes out and says things that are just simply not accurate. You mentioned one earlier today.
Well, Ron, it's like I am absolutely not a TDS, Trump derangement syndrome patient. I'm not. But I will defend the truth all day long. That's what I've done in my entire career. And so when I see lies, I got to point them out. It's not even about Trump, it's just that Trump has made it so that now everybody's freaking lying. It's making me crazy. You don't get to do the things that are being done in the print world. You never did. You get sued. So to watch the truth be dismantled piece by piece by piece, I've never been more aware than I am now of why they made the First Amendment, the freedom of the press and the freedom to gather and so on. It is the most important amendment, and it's being shredded. The daily onslaught of non-truths from he and his spokespeople and everybody around him are just having a deleterious effect on all of us. And it goes flat out against the face of what I grew up in Bingham and the concepts of honor, truth, integrity. It just doesn't work for me, and it's not derangement. It's me saying, I've had enough of that shit. I can't sit back, not myself, just let it go. And I'm not fully critical of those who remain in the Trump side. It's certainly not. I have way too many family, friends, and so on that remain, you know, either Republicans who haven't seen through it yet, or just staunch Trump people, or whatever. They're not bad people. A great number, too many of them are. And I don't want to see that number grow. And I feel like it must be stood up against that. We must stand up against that. Not against Trump is the man, or Trump is the creep, or Trump is the good husband or bad, but stand up for the things that we were. That's the American greatness I knew. I'd almost rather say that's when America was good. And I would like to see America and Americans be good again.
Yeah, we talked about that on the first issue and of the podcast, and I think it's true. It's going to be a reoccurring theme. We got to remember, however, and I say this as someone who I wrote a column for the City Weekly a while back where I said, I find no humor in Donald Trump. It's hard for me to write about him because there's no humor. I know that Weekend Update finds humor in him, but I don't. And I admire people who can write about it and write from a non-emotional point of view. But the fact of the matter is that lies that are told for personal aggrandizement, so that you're going to get something out of it, lies that are told for any reason to stay in power, lies that are told to get into power or to keep power, no matter who says them, are wrong. And the idea that they aren't because your side is right undermines exactly what we're supposed to do. And I'm going to go back a little bit in time to indicate a time where I was really disgusted with my own party, the Democratic Party, and that was with Bill Clinton. When Bill Clinton lied about having an affair, it wasn't an affair, he had sexual relations with a young woman that was an intern. And I remember so many of my friends and people at that time who were saying, well, yeah, but, and oh, you know, but what would be the other side? Same thing we hear from Trumpers about Clinton. And I, to my credit, I didn't do that. I didn't do it because if that was true, then he should have told the truth. He was a lawyer. And as a lawyer, you swear an oath to protect the Constitution of the United States and the state of Utah when you're sworn in here. He did that in Arkansas, and he ended up getting disbarred, and he should have. And the lawyers that will lie for Trump or Clinton, not represent them, there's a big difference. The people that will lie are no better than the worst of us, particularly when they have power. So be it Clinton or Trump or anybody else, whether they're the President of the United States or Joe Willie Brown, who's on trial in a court of law in some out-of-the-way circuit court in the South, they're supposed to tell the truth, as are their lawyers. And we've seen that just undermine. And so you have every right to be outraged, and I think we all have a right to be outraged.
Your career path and mine are the two staples of them, are swearing on a Bible and telling the truth. So yeah, you're right. I don't like to see, and by the way, I've seen the same thing that you saw. I've seen journalists pause their integrity and moral compass so they can get closer or access and not tell the truth or not be honorable. It happens every day. And this is the part, this is the slide that other societies have gone through in the past, and it never has a great ending. And I think the alert is there. It's the flashing red lights are there. The signal from Kennecott, the blast is going to go off, Ron, at 3:00. You better get the shit out of the way or you're going to get blown up. You know what I'm talking about, the DMV blast. So, and if you don't listen to that blast, you're going to get hurt. Well, the blast horn it's sounding. It isn't derangement. This isn't like, oh, I just don't like the guy. No, it is wrong. It's the wrong dang path. And, you know, for the record, I think that it should be spoken. I'm not new to dishonoring Trump. This happened for me in the early 1980s and has never left. When he was with the football league, they tried, and he first became kind of a celebrity of note beyond New York City. I go, this guy is just a creep. And he's been a creep forever. Curiously, what you said about Clinton, you know, he was the last president that left a surplus of an economy. And it was Obama who balanced the budget years later. Without going into the weeds about it, it's just damn ironic that we had a guy just elected predicated on building a good economy. But we've seen what good economies are, Clinton's and Obama's. And the people who support Trump don't recognize those are the steps we need to make that economy good again. And instead, turn it into a race of personality and a race of ratings and a race of my side, your side, as opposed to what's good for the country. And, you know, Clinton was brought down for the right reason. I was standing next to him at a conference. Everybody was lined up to shake his hand, and I got right next to him, and I thought, you know what, screw this. And I didn't. I just walked away. And this was after his presidency. He was every bit of a brilliant guy, I'll tell you that, if you ever met him live or saw him live. But a flawed man. And that was where I drew the line. When he lied, that was it for me.
Well, the thing about it is, and maybe we can wrap it up on this, is, and then you get the last word. I think it's important to say one thing. This country, the system of justice, can only work if people are prepared to tell the truth and seek out lies if they're told. And I loved doing that as a defense attorney. You can fight hard for your client, but you cannot cheat, steal, or lie. You can prosecute somebody hard, but you can't cheat, steal, or lie. You can make rulings from the bench, but you can't cheat, steal, or lie. There can't be an alternative motive to justice. And where we are today is, if it's our side, then everything they do is bad. If it's their side, everything we do is bad. No, you got to look to see if there is good. But you also got to be willing to call out your own side when they're bullshitting you. And we don't see that. We don't see it with a lot of journalists. You're right. We don't see it with lawyers. Lawyers, big law firms, multi-million dollar law firms who are rolling over and playing dead because Donald Trump threatened them. That's when courage counts. That's when being an American counts. That's why the people that came here that we talk about left their countries in large part because they were controlled by despots. We can't have that, and we can't have it again. And we should have it again, and we should demand that we have it again, but from both sides. And that's for the Democrats to step up to the plate, and you took a beating, and tell us why you lost, and come forward with it. And don't bullshit us about what the problem was.
Right. We can't, as Democrats or anybody, talk only about what Trump did wrong today. We have to have a solution. And right now, I'm not hearing solutions strongly vocalized from too many Democrat, I don't even have to say they have to be politicians, but leaders. And so I'm hopeful that in the next couple of years here before the midterms, some of those voices emerge and we end up with some strong voices in there. That said, Ron, you're right. We need to cut down. I'm just going to say in honor of the words that you just left with, I am going to fully embrace what I said about working people, hard working people, people who need to find justice in America, people who have found this land to be opening and endearing and welcoming and giving new opportunity. And therefore, I'm going to go to Grand Central today and buy 60 Welcome to America cards for those South Africans who just flew in here because they were suffering so badly in South America that they came here with luggages larger than you could fit into most airplanes, packing them through just like the migrants do from South America, just like the Asians do from overseas, just like your grandparents came with 5 cents in their pocket. But their 5 cents equals 85 luggage bags of horrific life existence. But they're welcome here now, and I want them to come, and hopefully they'll join the Democrat Party. Well, that's never going to happen. Why don't we just say goodbye, Ron, and do this next time?
It's a deal. Amen, brother.
You know who those guys are. Welcome, South Africa. People who were really put upon. Our newest Americans. We're here for you.
That's sarcasm, okay?
Well, it could be. Ron, okay, that's me, John, saying goodbye for this episode of Being a Boys. I will show my face next time, perhaps. Ron, off to you.
Well, have a good day, everybody, when you listen to this. And just... I hope we gave you something to think about. That's the purpose. Amen.
He's telling the truth. We'll see you.